This episode is brought to you by Fuli Gemstones.
It makes sense in the worry beads. Touching wood is Jesus's cross, isn't it? I mean, so again, for thousands of years, we have imbued objects with memory, with spirits, with luck, with calm, with spirituality, with God. And it's what we imbue them with and how we connect with them that will then impact outcome.
These sorts of needs don't discriminate. It affects a lot of different kinds of people. And of course, jewellery lovers and jewellery wearers are my main audience of people who really see the benefit in having something functional that you can really be proud of and that you want to invest in for not just the beauty of the object, but for yourself, for your self-care.
I'm Carol Horton, the voice of jewellery. Welcome to If Jewels Could Talk. I'm an author and broadcaster, and the woman who initiated the role of jewellery editor at magazines like Tatler and Vogue. This is a podcast for everyone, for people who do like jewellery, for people who don't realise they like jewellery, and anyone intrigued by fascinating facts, new ideas and forgotten histories. So join me as I tell sparkly tales and meet all sorts of people, delving into four centuries of jewellery culture, and investigate what's happening now. I'm here today with Britain's leading psychotherapist, author and podcaster, Julia Samuel. Julia, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, lovely to be with you, Carol. Lovely to see you and to be on your podcast.
We're here today because I was thinking about this subject, that originally jewellery was worn for both decorative and amuletic purposes. They beautified the human form, but also satisfied the superstitious human need for protection from danger, illness, and essentially the unknown. And the long story of jewellery has highlighted the creativity of our imagination as well as these primitive qualities of promoting well-being and safety and comfort that has remained a consistent factor. And a few weeks ago on the podcast, I talked to Dr. Aaron Celestian about how gemstones can be harnessed to fight physical disease. So I thought this morning we'd talk with Julia about the idea of how the ritual of jewellery wearing and gemstones can be used as a tool to help our mental health. So Julia, I wanted to know what you thought about that, about how rituals can be used by people to navigate the world.
Rituals are habits with soul, and rituals, we imbue whatever the ritual is with kind of meaning or purpose. And in, I think what you're talking about is often safety and connection. And safety and connection is the aspect of mental health that allows us to feel secure enough in our bodies to then problem solve, make good decisions, and to be open to love and connection, which is what we need for well-being. So if we're in a heightened state and we're frightened, we not only don't connect to other people, we don't think clearly, our thinking brain isn't online, but also we don't connect with ourselves. So many of us use stones and rituals to give us a sense of sort of calm and connection. So, you know, I've got my engagement ring that I'm wearing now that I was given by my husband, which we chose together when I was 20. That connects me with him. It represents many aspects that are kind of ritualized aspects, really, of love, of building a family, of nurture. I think rubies for me represent kind of love and warmth and connection. And my mum had a ruby engagement ring. So it is no, you know, I was 20, I didn't know what I was doing, but obviously I was influenced by my mum in choosing a ruby. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of patterns in it. But also I have a ring that is a Russian wedding ring, which has the handwriting of each of my children and from Michael and from me. And so when I put that on every morning, I kind of put my children close to my heart with the whole family. And because it's a Russian wedding ring, it feels like we're all bound together. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it gets loose, I get quite kind of nervous. So I use it in a way as both connection and as an amulet. Which is a kind of superstition as well.
It is, I guess, because if you've got those links joined on the golden hoop of the Russian wedding ring, you're keeping them safe and together. But I wonder, is it also that thing that in the morning, the repetitive behaviour kicks in of the ritual, in that if you put it on your finger, then everyone's safe?
Yes, I mean, that is not conscious. But I think repetitive behaviour is where you embed the psychological inputs of habits. So it's that you put them on without thinking. But if you suddenly notice that you haven't done it, there's a panic. So it's the absence of them that creates the dissonance. Mm-hmm. Whereas the habit, like, okay, I'm fully me. You know, I get up, I do my teeth, I get ready, I put my rings on, which is like I'm ready to go out into the world. And part of that is the rings that connect me to my husband, connect me to my kids and family.
And do you think in some ways by doing these patterns, comforting patterns in our life, that it's a way of exercising control over that bit that we can't control?
It is. I mean, if you look at the research about control, we have agency about 50% of the time and the rest is kind of random. And I think one of the, I mean, this may not connect to what you're saying, but I think one of the things of modern life is that we have a full sense of our control because we can book an aeroplane ticket and our lunch and a car and sort all sorts of things out within minutes on our phone. I think we have a full sense of our agency. And if you look at the history of jewels, I think people surrendered to the fact that everyone knew they were going to die, for instance. And so the jewels were a kind of prayer and a hope that they're going to go to heaven. They were part of that kind of belief system. I don't know now whether we put jewels on as a kind of form of control. I think habits give you a sense of balance, which gives you more agency to think clearly.
I was thinking, I mean, I wrote a whole book sort of that came out at the beginning of lockdown called The New Stone Age, because I was quite intrigued about this idea of holding on to talismanic things and how the ancients, really, it was all they had to rely on. And that this will keep me away from snakes. I won't get a snake bite and die. You know, it'll keep the evil away from my life and what is unknown, because I suppose they lived in such tiny communities and the big world out there was a complete unknown, that I felt a lot of young people were sort of returning to that because they didn't have much to hold on to in life, i.e. there was no sort of ritual of religion. People are far less of group communities, that social media is their gatekeeper, that is so unreliable. And I've noticed that there was this huge resurgence of people relying on holding crystal, meditating with crystal, having crystals around their home for comfort. And it was interesting to me that people were sort of going back to something that had been done for millennia.
Yes, I think, I mean, that makes sense to me. I can understand that. Wishing and hoping and praying, you know, even those of us that don't have organised faith, when something goes wrong, we tend to pray. And so particularly in the beginning of lockdown, when people were much more heightened and frightened, I think people did reach for things that kind of the ancients used. I got some money when my mum died, and I had these, can you see, I don't know if you can see,
you've got a little pendant on.
It's an evil eye. And I, with her money, I got one made for each of my daughters and me, so that we all wear it in different ways, too. One as a bracelet, the others as necklaces. And so instinctively, I've gone for an evil eye as well, even if I don't really believe it.
And what do you feel if you don't have that on?
I don't wear it every day. I don't feel scared, no.
It's funny, I wore an evil eye ring the whole of lockdown, just without thinking about it.
I mean, the other thing is, I think, which is linked to this, and this may be too big a reach, but also I think it's to do with power and the sense of if you wear a big fat ring, you have this sense of status. And I think why we have, you know, people who have a bit more front, who are always showing off how much they've got through their jewellery, have less behind. The more front you have, the bigger the back. And so, you know, if you're needing to wear enormous rocks all the time to kind of show your status, it could on the one hand show that you actually feel a bit diminished inside, but it also could give you a false sense, because it isn't true, of your kind of control or power over life. Like, I've got more, so I'm going to be all right.
Also, I read somewhere quite recently that Beyoncé, before she does a show, she listens to the same playlist of songs, says a prayer with every member of her band, does specific stretches, sits in a massage chair while she has her hair and makeup done, spends an hour meditating. So it's that ritual of behaviour that I guess you're guarding against having a good performance. If you do the same thing every time, it's going to go well.
Well, I mean, I think what that really does is by developing good habits, so a ritual is a good habit. Because our mind likes habits, our mind looks for shortcuts. So the minute she starts on that ritual before a show, her mind goes, okay, we're doing a show, because it knows what's happening. So it waits for you to do each thing, like you clean your teeth without thinking. In the same way, so once she's developed that ritual, her whole system fast tracks. It's like a rabbit run. It goes down it quickly. The marble run goes quickly, if you see what I mean. And so habits are incredibly, rituals before shows or performing or anything are incredibly good shortcuts or hacks, if you like, to a sense of calm. If we use them for calm. Other people have terrible habits before performing.
But I guess, I mean, do you subscribe to the whatever works for you? Or does it needs to be on a healthy basis?
Well, I mean, using anything that's mood altering isn't going to give you the connection to your kind of wisdom and your calm and to be able to respond if you're performing. Our system can go up in response to a demand, and then it always seeks to go down. It always seeks regulation. It's always looking for homeostasis, and it can freeze as well. So if we have our own habits, which could be wearing a ring or a bracelet or a necklace or earrings, whatever it is that you feel like are my lucky charms, that you feel calmer and safer, that will work for you to have more available to be able to do whatever it is that is frightening you.
Because you feel you've got that little gatekeeper level of protection.
Yeah.
And you've used it before and survived and it's gone well, so therefore you use it again. The same outcome will happen. When I wrote this book and I sent the first chapter in, and my publisher said, oh, we want some more about you, Carol, in it. So I sort of looked around. I thought, oh, I'll write about the black tourmaline I have on my desk. Oh, I'll write about the quartz I have on my shelf. I'll write about the pink Madagascan lump of quartz. And I suddenly realized I had quite a lot without thinking about it. And for me, it's looking inside these stones. And I think the connection to their sort of, in some cases, billion-year-old history and knowing that the Earth has survived all that time, that gives me a sense of calm.
Yes, that makes sense. I mean, I love fossils and looking in the stone and the colour. And there's this kind of very, as you say, it's like grounding, isn't it? I'm part of a much bigger, longer story that has been going on for billions of years. And touching this connects me back to that in that moment. It's kind of crazy how you can do that. And stones, not precious stones, but I don't know if there's an enormous difference. Stones, for literally as long as we know, have been used to represent the connection to the person that's died. So that there's Stonehenge or Roman stones for burial. And of course, you'd have been talking about the Egyptian stones in ancient Egypt. So we've used stones to commemorate and remember and mark an end and the beginning of a new relationship with someone for as long as we know.
And I think that connection, as you said, to the earth, but also to other people, ancestors who we haven't known and their lives that have carried on. I think that's quite significant, isn't it?
It is really significant.
In a weird way, because it does offer solace. You'd think about the end of people's life or the demise of things, the end of things. But actually, somehow, that's kind of comforting about our own existence.
Yes, I think it's normalising, isn't it? And that you're part of a bigger human story, not just your own story. So it slightly takes your ego out. You become a bit less narcissistic and a bit more kind
of... Remember, there are other people.
But have a bit of humility, like I'm mortal, like everyone before me is mortal, everyone after me is mortal. And I think there's something kind of quite humanising and releasing in that.
I found this lovely quote by John Berger, artist, and he said, that we find a crystal or a poppy beautiful means that we are less alone, that we're more deeply inserted into existence than the course of a single life would lead us to believe.
That's so beautiful. Really,
it sort of sums up what we were just saying, really, doesn't it? But in a very poetic way.
Yes, much better and more articulately, yeah.
So now we've talked about the power of positive thinking, which is essentially the sort of ritual and the talismanic aspect. I thought I wanted to talk a bit about the placebo effect, which is the literal believing something will work. I guess the idea of sort of stimulated healing has been around for a long time with the sort of shamans of Africa, the Native American medicine men, whose healing talents were obviously a lot of the time mobilizing the placebo effect through a ritual.
So, I mean, I think what's so interesting about what you're saying is that often instinctively we've known for millennia what works for us. And with research, placebo effect has been the dismissing thing. So the bit that you do the randomized control trial and you discount the impact of it from the placebo, where the person, so in a randomized control trial, you have half that take the pill and half that don't take the pill. The half that don't take the pill can have the placebo effect. So it can have a good effect on them because they believe the pill had the medicine in it. And it's been dismissed.
That's been dismissed.
As it's just the placebo effect.
But it's helped heal them.
helped them. But in the I don't quite know how long, but in the last kind of 10 years that I've known about, people are now researching the positive effects of the placebo, not in a dismissive way. And, you know, I just saw recently a research published in the Harvard Journal of Medicine. So a trial that was on migraines, 50% of people who did the trial had the positive impact of the placebo effect. So they didn't have the migraine medicine, but they felt better. 50% of them felt better. And when I've looked into this and talked to other doctors and professors, what they've said is that how you're communicated with by your doctor when he tells you your treatment will impact the impact of the treatment. So if you trust your doctor and he says, we're going to use this chemo treatment, and this chemo treatment is the best, and you trust and like your doctor, there is a placebo effect in the treatment that will improve your outcome.
Because your brain is very powerful.
Yeah.
And your brain, in some way, you're saying, will control your body. If your brain goes there, I'm going to get better, your body might follow.
Yes. I'm not saying don't have the chemo. I mean, the mind and the body are completely interconnected. So every thought that you have has a physiological outcome, and every physiological kind of hit of emotion you have triggers a thought. So the two systems kind of operate together. So you can, in a kind of simplistic term, if you don't like your doctor, you don't trust him, you feel frightened with the treatment he's giving you, and you're in a kind of heightened state then, and you kind of dread it all. Whereas if you trust them and you feel warmth and you feel he's a good man and this is going to be good for me, you're kind of open to it. And so that must be part of the impact.
There was actually a, this might be the study that you read, Ted Kapchuk, at the Harvard Medical School. And he is a leading figure in placebo studies and said, placebo has generally been denigrated in medicine, but I always wanted to figure out ways to ethically harness it because its therapeutic actions can be genuine and robust and its benefits should be promoted.
Yeah.
If you invest, as a lot of these people that I spoke to, and I did so many interviews for this book about people who were using crystals and in a beneficial way. Now, I met a lot of nutty people. I met things that didn't make sense. I also met a lot of people who'd actually changed the outcome of their lives using them. I met people who had been addicts. There was one woman who I met, and she basically, as part of her re-establishing her life, she'd been a real high flyer in the early 80s, a ton of coke, and landed up having to change her life. She worked with AIDS victims in the early 80s, and she said they used crystals as calming anxiety. I mean, obviously at that time, no one was going to actually get better, but it helped people find more peace and comfort in the days before their death. I also met a practitioner who dealt with trauma with ex-servicemen, using crystals in that way as calming, because if they can hold on to it, I guess they can get their mind back to that place where they're going to believe they're going to be okay. So I guess that's what I mean by placebo with with gemstones.
You know, it makes sense in the worry beads. Touching wood is Jesus's cross, isn't it? I mean, so again, for thousands of years, we have imbued objects with memory, with spirits, with luck, with calm, with spirituality, with God. And it's what we imbue them with and how we connect with them that will then impact outcome.
So it can shift your psychology if you use it often and with intent.
You have to believe it. Actually, funny enough, yes. I think part of my, when I did the placebo, I think Ash said to me, you don't even have to believe it's true. You just have to think it and it still has an impact.
I guess so, because I guess when you get up in the morning and you think my life's absolute rubbish and it's raining and nothing's going to go well for me today, you kind of talk yourself into that feeling, don't you? And the day goes badly.
And that's, I mean, there's a whole therapy based on that, which is called cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, if you change your thinking, that changes your feeling and that changes your behavior. So that if you wake up and you see it's raining and you kind of say to yourself it's going to be a bad day, then you choose to do the things that's going to make it. I might as well have five coffees and a croissant. Whereas you might choose different behaviours. Okay, I'm going to go out. It's a bad day, but I want to make the best of it. I'm going to go outside, let the rain fall on my face, move my body, ring a friend, do things that make me feel good. So then that changes your day.
So how powerful is the brain, Julia?
All powerful. It really is. I mean, I think we're only just beginning. We are literally at the foothills of what we understand, the mind and the brain. And the mind and the brain are two, in some ways, different entities. So the brain is the architecture that has all these pathways, you know, your imaginative network, your executive network, your hippocampus, all these different aspects. And then your mind is like the people running through the streets and how they connect and the sense that they make of them. And neuroscience, MRI scans are really at the forefront of new understandings and also personalizing. I think soon will be that, you know, if you have depression, you may be able to have an MRI that can see what is it within your brain that is causing it and how that can impact you by changing what you think or what you eat or how much you sleep or how much you move, who you connect with. So, I mean, I think it's incredibly exciting.
With more awareness and more research, we'll get to the point where we can really control ourselves more by...
No. I think control is such a like off and on switch.
Okay.
Or influence.
We have more agency. I think knowledge gives us choices. And there's an enormous amount of knowledge everybody ignores every day already. So, I mean,
what should we not ignore every day?
That we need to connect to people. You know, the single biggest predictor of our lifespan, how long we live, how healthy we are, how happy we are, and how wealthy we are, is the quality of our relationships. The connection we have with others defines the quality of our lives. So we need to prioritize them. And prioritize isn't just have one of lots of priorities. Prioritize is one priority. That is your priority. How you do it is very unique and individual, but we don't. Moving their bodies has a huge impact. How you move your body, how much you move your body, what you put into your body, all of that is better than any medicine you will ever have.
Do you think, I mean, because getting back to this thing, I talked to Charlotte Tilbury for the book and she said she put the mobile phones at the cause of everything. She said, we're just too busy. And this has made us busy. I mean, do you think that's why we don't prioritise things? Because we're also so busy scrambling around, making plans, doing things.
I really don't blame mobile phones. There is an epidemic of busyness. And busyness is an anaesthetic. It blocks your emotions. You can get into tons of terrible habits with busyness. And you don't listen to your inner wisdom if you're super busy. Slowing down, connecting with our internal world, working out, what we need, who we can help. You know, helping others is as effective as being helped, more so. You know, there's lots of research that altruism, if you're helping other people, is an antidepressant.
And if we have, like your ring or like my rock crystal on my desk or something, that object which we use to intend us to remind us of this, that object can then have a knock-on beneficial effect in our life.
I don't see why not.
So it's got to be a reminder of something significant.
I think we have to imbue it with that. Mm. So we make of it what we want it to be. And then it becomes that for us. Our relationship with it becomes more significant.
It does seem that, you know, technology has speeded things up. It's changing everybody's jobs. It's changing where they live, how they live. And I wondered if this ability to adapt and this stress resiliency, do you think is going to be a very important skill that we all develop?
I did write a whole book about this.
It's This Too Shall Pass.
And the key, you know, the main message in my book is we are wired to adapt and change, and our capacity to adapt and change, which is allowing us to kind of face the change, to let the discomfort of it, the pain of it, to come through us and change us so that we grow through it rather than shut down and block it out, has an enormous impact on our mental health and our well-being.
And that is going to be a huge thing. I think particularly, do you see a sort of, you know, everybody talks about Gen Z, and do you see a big change in how different generations cope, have coping strategies?
I think the change is different for different generations. So if you look at my parents' generation and their grandparents, they lived through two world wars. Us baby boomers, we lived through a lot of institutional change, you know, that we don't believe in the church, the institution of marriage is less, all the institutions of feminism, women being educated, there's, you know, the pill, there's so much change we've lived through, which I think a lot of us would see are as beneficial changes. I think for our children, what's really changed is the place of work and how to be in relationship. So that you and I, probably when we started work, expected to be in the same job or for the same company, and they invested in you and supported you. And now it's people do three or four different jobs, or they will certainly do three or four different careers through their lifetime. So you have to upskill and change and adapt and be open to that. And also how to be in relationship, looking at young people, you know, men and women, that with their roles in relationship are changed. You know, you can, all the different ways of being in a relationship, whether it's your sexuality, whether it's your gender, whether it's you're going to be monogamish, open-ish, committed, all of those aspects, I think, are choice people want, but also choice is confusing. And you can get kind of log-jammed in, like, I don't even know who I am because there's too many choice.
I think what's good is they're propelling jewellery back to what it was, because I think for them, what they wear and how they wear it has got to have meaning to them, and it's got to have some emotional investment or some spiritual investment, some connection. They're very much using it as humans did originally.
For social reasons and...
Yes. So I think that's quite interesting that it's sort of cyclical. It's gone from the big rocks and the social status, I'm sure it is, and some people's lives, but I think in the general mass, and particularly for that age group, it's something quite different and it's much more meaningful. Well, Julia, thank you very much for sharing that wisdom and insight. Long may your Russian wedding ring sit happily on your finger.
Oh, thank you. Me too. And thank you. It was a lovely conversation, Karen.
So I'm now sitting with Charlotte Garnett, designer, maker of jewellery, and who recently spoke at one of the world's leading neurodiversity conferences on mental health in Edinburgh, called ITACOM. And she believes that jewellery can be incredibly helpful, a helpful tool for people who are coping with neurodiversity. Now, Charlotte, what are people dealing with who have neurodiversity?
So neurodiversity is a big umbrella term. Essentially, it is a modern term for anything that isn't what we would call the typical. So if you're neurotypical, then you wouldn't be struggling with anything. If you're neurodiverse, then that is a coverall term that takes it away from saying ill and normal, because that isn't what these things are anymore. And our understanding of them has developed to the point where we understand that some things aren't there to be cured. They are just atypical. So neurodiversity covers everything that isn't the typical.
So like what? So like anxiety, depression?
Exactly. Anxiety, depression. So for me personally, my neurodiversity comes in the form of anxiety, depression and an eating disorder.
And you had those from quite a young age?
Yes. So I probably started seeing the symptoms of depression around age 7. These sorts of things can manifest very young in a lot of different people. That then developed into an eating disorder in my teen years, which is very common for a lot of young women, especially in those formative years. Then as I was going through treatment for an eating disorder, which is under the umbrella of an anxious disorder, that then sort of was repressed and came out the other side into pure anxiety and an anxious disorder. These disorders don't necessarily go away. I think that's a big misconception, is that you go through treatment and you're cured and fixed. That was something I believed would happen. I went into it thinking, fantastic, I'm going to be fixed. And that was one of the things that I've come to realise as an adult and is pervasive in the sort of work that I do. Some things aren't going to be fixed. Some things don't need fixing. It's about learning to live with them and be supported and find proper coping mechanisms that will last for the rest of your life.
Hence, your idea to include what you'd been through in your jewellery. Because you were at Central St Martin's.
That's right.
And started floundering, was it in your final year?
Yes, really looking back on it, it was far before then. Mm-hmm. Really struggling, which every designer does, to find that sense of identity and a true sense of purpose. And then it was in my third year where I was presenting to Naomi Filmer, who I was lucky enough to have as my tutor in third year. Naomi Filmer is a conceptual jeweller. Mm. Absolutely, everyone should look her up. She makes things that are on the absolute fringes of jewellery into art, so that conceptual jewellery art world. Fantastic work, and something I was very inspired by, that high concept jewellery. I was trying to describe the concept I was trying to come up with around subcultures, and she was looking at me and not buying what I was selling to her. And I just broke down and said, look, I'm really sorry. I'm quite embarrassed, actually, because I was quite starstruck by her as well. And she just saw straight through my floundering and really got to the root of it and was quite direct and asked me, what is going on with you? And I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I've just been diagnosed with anxiety, because that it was at that point in final year I actually got officially diagnosed with anxiety. And she said, okay. And I was like, well, it's really all-consuming and it's all I can think about at the moment. I can't really do anything outside of it. And she said, and you've just been sitting here telling me you want to do subcultures because you want to explore your identity and this is what's all-consuming. So why aren't you doing that? And it was such a penny drop moment of, why aren't I doing that? You're absolutely right. My whole thing I'd done when I was working artistically, ever since I was a young child, I never kept a written diary. I kept an art journal. I would draw out everything. I'd always found an inspiration to create from an autobiographical standpoint, working on what was motivating me and what I felt. And it was such an obvious route. I thought, of course, that's absolutely what I should be doing. From then on, it was just really easy because the inspiration was within me. I wasn't searching for something outside and then finding a way to put an original twist on it. Everything that I needed to create original work was coming from within.
And so what did your graduation collection look like?
So my graduation collection was called Cure for the Itch. And it immediately became, right, how do I help myself in this? Because something I'd always done and what had sort of erred me away from it was two things. Firstly, the stigma. So, of course, there is a huge stigma around mental illness and mental health, people not wanting to talk about it because you are seen as less than and inferior. But the second part of that was being functional. And something I'd always done in my artworks was simply portray what I was feeling to the best of my abilities and let people know how I was feeling with that artwork. And that's what I'd seen working autobiographically as an artist, because I believe jewellery is an art form, a very sentimental art form at that. I really wanted that penny drop moment for me with Naomi in that critique, thinking, OK, so I'm going to work around what I'm feeling, but why? And it was the why that brought the functionality into the work, thinking, because I want to do something about it. It's not purely about displaying this emotion. I want to do something with it. So that's when I started to really dive deep into the psychology behind, okay, how does jewellery interact with that? And that's when I started to really dig into how I functioned with jewellery and the body and that actual tactile way that we can help ourselves in therapies, delving back into the therapies that I'd actually been through myself myself and how tactility came into that.
So that's what the handling of objects, fidgeting with objects.
Yes.
So exactly how did that. It manifest in the jewellery?
So one of the things I started with was thinking back to advice I'd been given in therapy, which was things like wear an elastic band and snap that against your wrist.
That, so what does that do?
That is
what
meant
that
to be...
Exactly, apart from like hurt yourself.
Apart from looking really unattractive. That was specifically given as a coping mechanism for people suffering with self-harm motives. And that was a way of satisfying the need for what is essentially tactile stimulation, just a very extreme version of that. And it comes back to the practice of grounding. And what that is bringing your mind back to the present. So when your thoughts and feelings are spiraling out of control, you bring yourself back into the present with sensation. And a lot of these different things come to stimulation and overstimulation. We have so much stimulus in the world today that a lot of us are constantly overstimulated. And when you bring neurodiversity and mental illness into the equation, that overstimulation can happen very quickly. So having a way to cut through that overstimulation and bring yourself back to the present is really powerful. So what I was doing was working to find ways to facilitate that in a tactile way. And something that a lot of us do anyway is go and touch our jewellery. It's a natural thing that we all have built into us called stimming. And stimming is a word that's mainly used to refer to autism and the coping mechanisms that people generally see as being associated with autism. And those are repetitive manual habits or physical habits that people have. But what they actually are ways to cut through that overstimulation and bring yourself back to one point. And of course, autism is a spectrum, and it doesn't matter who you are or how you associate, everyone is on that spectrum, be it right down one end or right down the other. And everyone can suffer from overstimulation. So stims are actually things that everyone does, a behaviour everyone can associate with that we bring into our daily life to cut through that overstimulation, whether it's something as simple as fiddling with your earring, rearranging your hair in a way that comforts you, fiddling with a button. It's something that everyone can associate with. So what I did was then harness the way that we stim and the way that we fidget in a way that comforts ourselves and bring that into something that was practical.
And so how did it manifest? The snap of the band, how did you recreate that in jewellery?
So the first thing that I started doing was creating shapes that my fingers wanted to go to. I started by creating hundreds of these shapes, just trying to be really intuitive with it and make these little clay models. And because I was at St. Martin's, which is such a notoriously high-stress environment, I would leave them out on the tables before we all had our critiques and let everyone take a couple. And it became very natural to see what everyone was gravitating to. Whether those were my neurodiverse friends or my neurotypical friends, everyone started choosing their favourites and then saying, oh, I've actually got a crit this afternoon. Can I have that one, please? And it started to become really obvious to me what was working and what wasn't from this series of objects I'd made, because it was very easy for me to make for myself. When I brought other people to the equation, I needed to then have that feedback from them. So it started with these objects that could be handled. The snap of the band feeling was something I really zoned in on my later work, because it is a thought that I kept going back to, that real intense stimulation. And something I realized that I had done completely inadvertently in making my work was one of the first ever pieces I made at uni was a really rubbish copper ring that I'd made really poorly, and the joint, the solder joint, was completely overflowing because it was my first ever go at it. But I'd worn it because it was the first thing I'd made, so of course I wore it. And as it wore down over the years, it ended up making a big ridge of solder on the inside, and I found myself going back to it time and time again. And it wasn't until I actually lost the ring I realised, oh God, I feel quite the void on my finger where I was wearing it. Perhaps I should replace that. And that's where I started creating my point rings, which have become my complete top seller, which are a simple band with a secret point on the inside, little sharp point that is soft enough that you can wear constantly. I've worn mine since the day I designed it, and sharp enough that when you start to turn it around and push it onto your finger, it gives you that sensory input that your brain needs to interrupt those thoughts. That feeling. I've then elaborated into the rest of my later collections and really exaggerated in things like my peak rings, which have two sides on them, one of which is softer and one of which is much sharper. And it's a real statement piece. I love the sculptural nature of contemporary jewellery. So drawing that aesthetic quality of something that I want to be proud to wear and something that I'm really drawn to, in with the real functional side of it, which is that it gives me overwhelming stimulatory relief when I'm very anxious, makes for a very wearable piece of contemporary jewellery for me.
So do you make these in yellow gold?
Absolutely. I use a real range of different materials. I started with bronze and particularly woods. I started using ebony wood because it's so dense and buttery soft, and it has a real material comfort to it, and it's just in its presence and in its touch quality. I don't like having a material bias just towards what would be considered luxurious materials. However, that's not to say that I don't use luxurious materials. Gold in itself has a beautiful, buttery, tactile quality to it and is a really gorgeous material to touch and be around. On top of that, yes, like you mentioned, marble. I have a real love of marble. I started being inspired by thinking, I wish I could touch that. An experience I regularly have when I'm going around the V&A. You go into that marble section, you see all the sculptures, and God, I wish I could touch all of the folds of fabric on there.
So the kinetic idea of jewellery is very important to you.
Absolutely.
Touching, feeling, offering comfort through the touch and feel.
Yes, exactly. And of course, kinetic jewellery isn't something new. That's something that we've seen historically through jewellery a lot. One of the artists that I took massive inspiration from when I started was Michael Berger, who is a fantastic jeweller who creates these spinning pieces that look like they'll spin forever. What I wanted to do with that kinetic element was make it purpose-made. So make something that, instead of being a novelty or for the pure craftsmanship of it, you can harness those things and make it purpose-built so that it does what you want it to do and comforts you and brings you that sense of mental clarity.
So it's all about bringing the mind back and self-soothing.
Yes.
Through the jewellery. So it's not just rings. Do you take that into earrings and bracelets as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I started purely on objects. To me, an object that interacts with the body is jewellery. If it interacts with the body in some way, it's a form of jewellery. So I stayed with objects, and I still have a great love of making objects that interact with the body. But then I wanted to bring in that accessibility and give people what my vision was for this jewellery in a way that would actually suit what they were already doing. And like I was saying, these behaviours are really innate to a lot of us. It's something that most of us don't even notice that we're doing. And I'd implore everyone to pay attention to your hands when you start fidgeting, and you will find the one thing that you do, whether it is twiddling with your earring or going to your ring. A lot of people go to their wedding bands as well without actually thinking about it. So by then creating wearable jewellery, which is what I actually called my next collection, was wearables, bringing that vision into a wearable, recognisable realm that could then be more accessible for people who'd already built these habits around their jewellery.
And so do you have little acupressure points, the spikes on the ears as well?
I make, in my collections, I have pierced jewellery for earrings. I certainly do commissions that are based around that. I do have a lot of people who talk to me about the acupressure side of it.
And what's the sort of age group that you appeal to? Is this bought by mainly younger people?
So it's a really good question, and obviously one that I think about a lot. It's very difficult to actually pin it down to one age group. Of course, my most popular is that sort of age range between around a similar age to me, around the sort of 30s. People that have done that work to realise who they are and what they want out of life and are invested in self-care and really make that a priority at that point in their lives. However, I have had clients from the age of 8 all the way up. So it's a huge range of people, and it really resonates with a lot of different people because these sorts of needs don't discriminate. It affects a lot of different kinds of people. And of course, jewellery lovers and jewellery wearers are my main audience of people who really see the benefit in having something functional that you can really be proud of and that you want to invest in for not just the beauty of the object, but for yourself, for your self-care.
And there's nothing else in fashion that could have this effect as well. I mean, you can buy a dress or a pair of shoes and it can make you feel good for 5 minutes, but that's a very sort of passing, fleeting moment. It's not going to go on and actually have an effect in your life.
Exactly that. In my research into psychology, I had that perfect, yes, I'm really onto the right thing here moment. I was reading a study by Bob Hershon, and he was talking about a group of women called Les Tricoteuses, which were women in French Revolution era. And they would have to watch the beheadings in this French Revolution era. Watching a beheading is very traumatic, whether you wanted to see that person at their end or not. The actual act of watching something that brutal is very traumatic to the person, very stressful. And they went down in history as being these really blasé, typically French women, because they would knit while they were watching beheadings every time and keep a straight face. And everyone would say, oh, how blasé to keep this straight face and knit. But what Bob Hershon was saying in this study was what they were doing wasn't being blasé by knitting. That was a coping mechanism. That was them stimming. That was them finding a way to ground themselves and stay calm whilst watching something so incredibly brutal. And this repetitive manual action of knitting is a perfect way to ground yourself and be mindful by doing a repetitive manual action. And he ended the study by saying, this is all well and good, but it's not practical to carry around an emergency knitting kit in times of stress. And I thought, well, you know what is? Jewellery. That is the perfect thing to carry around in times of stress.
I guess the great thing, the very good repetitive movement, is stringing beads.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Stringing beads is a great one. It's that thing that's akin to knitting, repetitive manual action. And the key is that you don't have to overthink it. Craft has always been one of those outlets I think people haven't necessarily realised that actual benefit of. And I think just now, like we were saying at the beginning, the conversations around self-care and what we can actually do for ourselves, particularly during COVID times, became, okay, what can I do right now? What do I have in my vicinity that's going to help me? And really paying attention to that. And I feel that has really helped in raising the profile of craft itself as a way of venting these feelings.
Do you think if somebody had given you one of your rings at a much younger age, like 9 or 10, do you think that might have made a difference, a big difference?
I really think it would have helped me in a lot of ways. Particularly, I look back on some of my first therapy sessions when I was so young and so cripplingly anxious without having the words for it. And what I'd actually do was sit and pick. I remember particularly one therapy room that had a box of tissues next to you. And I would go through the entire box of tissues, not crying, but pulling one out and screwing it up into a little thing, putting it to the side, pulling out another tissue and screwing that up or ripping it into little pieces. And it was because I was desperately looking for something to do with my hands whilst I was trying to process these emotions and grasp my words and not spiral off into a panic attack. I actually ended up designing a piece around this because it was something my best friend to this day still does, is twist tissues into little pieces. So I made the nubbin pocket pebble with the twists of tissue and arranged them to look like rutilated quartz. So it was that ideology, that sort of Alexander McQueen-esque ideology of making something beautiful out of something that was grotesque. So taking these sort of shameful trails of tissues that we'd left behind us that were so embarrassing when you stood up off the sofa to find this trail of tissues around you that you'd inadvertently made, and making that into something beautiful. And perhaps if I'd have had one of those pocket pebbles, I wouldn't have had that embarrassment surrounding me. Or from the pulled out eyelashes, that was one of my coping mechanisms. It's called trichotillomania, and that's a specific type of this manual coping mechanism, trying to find something repetitive that I wasn't necessarily conscious I was doing, pulling all my eyelashes out on one side and one side of my hair. So if I'd had those objects, I wouldn't have had to reach to coping mechanisms that felt so shameful or were so embarrassing or detrimental to me, to my physical health. And I would have had that outlet to let them out onto in a constructive way. Because actually suppressing these types of need for stimulus and external tactility and a way to vent these feelings and that energy is healthy. There's a reason this is a built-in way for us to process these emotions. So having a healthy outlet certainly would have benefited.
Do you get feedback? Do you have any clients who come back and tell you what's happened to them after they've worn your ring or how it's helped or benefited them?
Absolutely. That is my number one favourite thing about my profession, is the connection and the feedback I get from my clients, some of which have become my really good friends from actually just keeping on checking back in and then wanting to see the new prototypes, and that's just led to a really natural friendship.
And so will you talk more at mental health conferences, Charlotte?
I'd absolutely love to. So the ITACOM, It Takes All Kind of Mind conference, was probably the highlight of my career, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's something I'm incredibly proud to have taken part in. It's gone on to win awards, and actually the founder, Sophie Dow, has just been announced that she's being given the King's Medal in Sweden for her contributions, very deservedly so. And being in that sort of environment is very unusual for a jeweller. Of course, I was the only jeweller there. You don't find a lot of artists at psychology conferences, but it was one I was so pleased to be at. And I think a multidisciplinary approach in any walk of life is really valuable, even just as an artist. Not being constricted to one discipline, one media, being able to branch out. And I think some of the best artists' multidisciplinary approach, looking at many different things. And for me, psychology and talking at these sorts of conferences and meeting people whose practices are being professors, that is another facet of being multidisciplinary to me.
That's very rewarding. So rewarding. Thank you very much indeed, Charlotte, for coming and sharing your story and other people's stories with us. Thank you.
And thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. For this and other episodes of If Jewels Could Talk, please go to our website, carolwalton.com/podcasts. And if you've enjoyed it, please share it any way you can. We also have a new YouTube channel, so check that out. And on it, we'll have some images of jewellery and sort of extra films and pieces of information. So do take a look at that. And if you've got any ideas or want to see anything specific, please let me know. I'm at Carol Walton on Instagram. And join me again in 2 weeks for my next jewelled nugget, when we're going to Paris. We're going to a very special room in Paris together, where I'll be talking about one specific female designer. You have 2 weeks to guess who. Anyway, join me then, and thank you for listening. Goodbye. If Jewels Could Talk with Carol Walton is produced by Natasha Cowan, music and editing by Tim Thornton, graphics by Scott Bentley, illustration by Geordie Labanda. You can find our sponsors at fullygemstones.com and me at carolwalton.com.